12. In the end, it wasn't such of a much, and Roland was glad. Hax was carried in an open cart, but only his huge girth gave him away. He had been blindfolded with a wide black cloth that hung down over his face. A few threw stones, but most merely continued with their breakfasts as they watched. A gunslinger whom the boy did not know well, he was glad his father had not drawn the black stone, led the fat cook carefully up the steps. Two guards of the watch had gone ahead and stood on either side of the trap. When Hax and the gunslinger reached the top, the gunslinger threw the noosed rope over the cross tree and then put it over the cook's head, dropping the knot until it lay just below the left ear. The birds had all flown, but Roland knew they were waiting.
"Do you wish to make confession?" the gunslinger asked.
"I have nothing to confess," Hax said.
His words carried well, and his voice was oddly dignified in spite of the muffle of cloth which hung over his lips. The cloth ruffled slightly in the faint, pleasant breeze that had blown up.
"I have not forgotten my father's face. It has been with me through all."
Roland glanced sharply at the crowd and was disturbed by what he saw there, a sense of sympathy, perhaps admiration. He would ask his father. When traitors are called heroes, or heroes traitors, he supposed in his frowning way, dark times must have fallen. Dark times indeed. He wished he understood better. His mind flashed to court and the bread court had given them. He felt contempt. The day was coming when court would serve him. Perhaps not Cuthbert, perhaps Bert would buckle under court's steady fire and remain a page or a horseboy or, infinitely worse, a perfumed diplomat, dallying in receiving chambers or looking into bogus crystal balls with doddering kings and princes. But he would not. He knew it. He was for the open lands and long rides. That this seemed a good fate was something he would marvel over later in his solitude. "Roland, I'm here." He took Cuthbert's hand, and their fingers locked together like iron.
"Charge be capital murder and sedition," the gunslinger said. "You have crossed the white, and I, Charles, son of Charles, consign you ever to the black."
The crowd murmured, some in protest.
"I never
tell your tale in the underworld, maggot," said Charles of Charles,
and yanked the lever with both yellow gauntleted hands. The trap dropped. Hax plummeted through, still trying to talk. Roland never forgot that. The cook went, still trying to talk. And where did he finish the last sentence he would ever begin on earth? His words were ended by the sound an exploding pine knot makes on the hearth in the cold heart of a winter night. But on the whole, he thought it not so much. The cook's legs kicked out once in a wide Y. The crowd made a satisfied whistling noise. The guards of the watch dropped their military pose and began to gather things up negligently. Charles, son of Charles, walked back down the steps slowly, mounted his horse and rode off, cutting roughly through one gaggle of picnickers, quirting a few of the slow coaches, making them scurry. The crowd dispersed rapidly after that, and in 40 minutes the two boys were left alone on the small hill they had chosen. The birds were returning to examine their new prize. One lit on Hax's shoulder and sat there, chummily, darting its beak at the bright and shiny hoop Hax had always worn in his right ear.
"It doesn't look like him at all," Cuthbert said.
"Oh, yes, it does," Roland said confidently as they walked toward the gallows, the bread in their hands. Bert looked abashed. They paused beneath the cross tree, looking up at the dangling, twisting body. Cuthbert reached up and touched one hairy ankle defiantly. The body started on a new twisting arc. Then, rapidly, they broke the bread and spread the rough chunks beneath the dangling feet. Roland looked back just once as they rode away. Now there were thousands of birds. The bread, he grasped this only dimly, was symbolic then.
It was good, Cuthbert said suddenly. I liked it. I did.
Roland was not shocked by this, although he had not particularly cared for the scene, but he thought he could perhaps understand what Bert was saying. Perhaps he'd not finish as a diplomat after all. Jokes and easy line of talk or not.
I don't know about that, he said, but it was something. It surely was.
The land did not fall to the good man for another 5 years. And by that time, Roland was a gunslinger. His father was dead. He himself had become a matricide. And the world had moved on. The long years and long rides had begun. XIII.
Look, Jake said, pointing upward.
The gunslinger looked up and felt a twinge in his right hip. He winced. They had been in the foothills 2 days now, and although the water skins were almost empty again, it didn't matter now. There would soon be all the water they could drink. He followed the vector of Jake's finger upward, past the rise of the green plain, to the naked and flashing cliffs and gorges above it, on up toward the snowcap itself. Faint and far, nothing but a tiny dot, it might have been one of those motes that dance perpetually in front of the eyes, except for its constancy. The gunslinger beheld the man in black moving up the slopes with deadly progress, a minuscule fly on a huge granite wall.
"Is that him?" Jake asked.
The gunslinger looked at the depersonalized mote doing its faraway acrobatics, feeling nothing but a premonition of sorrow. "That's him, Jake."
Do you think we'll catch him?
Not on this side, on the other. And not if we stand here talking about it.
They're so high, Jake said. What's on the other side?
I don't know, the gunslinger said. I don't think anybody does. Maybe they did once. Come on, boy. They began to move upward again, sending small runnels of pebbles and sand down toward the desert that washed away behind them in a flat bake sheet that seemed to never end. Above them, far above, the man in black moved up and up and up. It was impossible to see if he looked back. He seemed to leap across impossible gulfs, to scale sheer faces. Once or twice he disappeared, but always they saw him again, until the violet curtain of dusk shut him from their view. When they made their camp for the evening, the boy spoke little, and the gunslinger wondered if the boy knew what he himself had already intuited. He thought of Cuthbert's face, hot, dismayed, excited. He thought of the bread. He thought of the birds. It ends this way, he thought. Again and again it ends this way. There are quests and roads that lead ever onward, and all of them end in the same place, upon the killing ground. Except, perhaps, the road to the tower. There, Ka might show its true face. The boy, the sacrifice. His face, innocent and very young in the light of their tiny fire, had fallen asleep over his beans. The gunslinger covered him with the horse blanket and then curled up to sleep himself. Chapter 3. The Oracle and the Mountains. 1. The boy found the oracle, and it almost destroyed him. Some thin instinct brought the gunslinger up from sleep to the velvet darkness which had fallen on them at dusk. That had been when he and Jake reached the grassy, nearly level oasis above the first rise of tumbled foothills. Even on the hard scrabble below, where they had toiled and fought for every foot in the killer sun, they'd been able to hear the sound of crickets rubbing their legs seductively together in the perpetual green of willow groves above them. The gunslinger remained calm in his mind, and the boy had kept up at least the pretense of a facade, and that had made the gunslinger proud. but Jake hadn't been able to hide the wildness in his eyes, which were white and starry, the eyes of a horse scenting water and held back from bolting only by the tenuous chain of its master's mind. Like a horse at the point where only understanding, not the spur, could hold it steady. The gunslinger could gauge the need in Jake by the madness the sounds of the crickets bred in his own body. His arms seemed to seek out shale to scrape on, and his knees seemed to beg to be ripped in tiny, maddening, salty gashes. The sun trampled them all the way. Even when it turned a swollen, feverish red with sunset, it shone perversely through the knife cut in the hills off to their left, blinding them and making every teardrop of sweat into a prism of pain. Then there was sawgrass. At first only yellow scrub, clinging with gruesome vitality to the bleak soil where the last of the runoff reached. Further up there was witchgrass, first sparse, then green and rank, then the sweet smell of real grass mixed with timothy and shaded by the first of the dwarfed firs. There the gunslinger saw an arc of brown moving in the shadows. He drew, fired, and felled the rabbit all before Jake could begin to cry out his surprise. A moment later he had reholstered the gun. "Here," the gunslinger said. Up ahead the grass deepened into a jungle of green willows that was shocking after the parched sterility of the endless hardpan. There would be a spring, perhaps several of them, and it would be even cooler, but it was better out here in the open. The boy had pushed every step he could push, and there might be sucker bats in the deeper shadows of the grove. The bats might break the boy's sleep, no matter how deep it was, and if they were vampires, neither of them might awaken. At least, not in this world. The boy said, "I'll get some wood." The gunslinger smiled. "No, you won't. Sit yourself, Jake." Whose phrase had that been? Some woman. Susan? He couldn't remember. Time's the thief of memory. That one he knew. That one had been Vanay's. The boy sat. When the gunslinger got back, Jake was asleep in the grass. A large praying mantis was performing ablutions on the springy stem of the kid's cowlick. The gunslinger snorted laughter, the first in God's knew how long, and set the fire and went after water. The willow jungle was deeper than he had suspected and confusing in the failing light. But he found a spring, richly guarded by frogs and peepers. He filled one of their water skins and paused. The sounds that filled the night awoke an uneasy sensuality in him, a feeling that not even Allie, the woman he had bedded with in Tull, had been able to bring out. Too much of his time with Allie had been business. He chalked it up to the sudden blinding change from the desert. After all those miles of bleak hardpan, the softness of the dark seemed nearly decadent. He returned to the camp and skinned the rabbit while water boiled over the fire. Mixed with the last of their canned veg, the rabbit made an excellent stew. He woke Jake and watched him as he ate, bleary but ravenous. "We stay here tomorrow," the gunslinger said.
"But that man you're after, that priest..."
"He is no priest. And don't worry, he'll keep."
"How do you know that?"
The gunslinger could only shake his head. The intuition was strong in him, but it was not a good intuition. After the meal, he rinsed the cans from which they had eaten, marveling again at his own water extravagance, and when he turned around, Jake was asleep again. The gunslinger felt the now familiar rising and falling in his chest that he could only identify with Cuthbert. Cuthbert had been Roland's own age, but he had seemed so much younger. His cigarette drooped toward the grass, and he tossed it into the fire. He looked at it, the clear yellow burn so different, so much cleaner from the way the devil grass burned. The air was wonderfully cool, and he lay down with his back to the fire. Far away, through the gash that led the way into the mountains, he heard the thick mouth of the perpetual thunder. He slept and dreamed. 2. Susan Delgado, his beloved, was dying before his eyes. He watched, his arms held by two villagers on each side, his neck dog-caught in a huge rusty iron collar. This wasn't the way it had happened. He hadn't even been there, but dreams had their own logic, didn't they? She was dying. He could smell her burning hair, could hear their cries of charyu tree. And he could see the color of his own madness. Susan, lovely girl at the window, horseman's daughter. How she had flown across the drop, her shadow, that of horse and girl, merged, a fabulous creature out of an old story, something wild and free. How they had flown together in the corn. Now they were flinging corn husks at her, and the husks caught fire even before they caught in her hair. "Charyu tree, charyu tree," they cried, these enemies of light and love. And somewhere the witch was cackling. Rhea, the witch's name, had been. And Susan was turning black in the flames, her skin cracking open, and what was she calling? "The boy," she was screaming, "Roland, the boy." He whirled, pulling his captors with him. The collar ripped at his neck, and he heard the hitching, strangled sounds that were coming from his own throat. There was a sickish, sweet smell of barbecuing meat on the air. The boy was looking down at him from a window high above the funeral pyre, the same window where Susan, who had taught him to be a man, had once sat and sung the old songs, "Hey Jude," and "Ease On Down the Road," and "Careless Love." He looked out from the window like the statue of an alabaster saint in a cathedral. His eyes were marble. A spike had been driven through Jake's forehead. The gunslinger felt the strangling, ripping scream that signaled the beginning of his lunacy pull up from the bottom of his belly. Three. Roland grunted a cry as he felt the fire singe him. He sat bolt upright in the dark, still feeling the dream of Magus around him, strangling him like the collar he'd worn. In his twistings and turnings, he had thrown one hand against the dying coals of the fire. He put the hand to his face, feeling the dream flee, leaving only the stark picture of Jake, plaster white, a saint for demons. He glared around at the mystic darkness of the willow grove, both guns out and ready. His eyes were red loopholes in the last glow from the fire. Jake. The gunslinger was up and on the run. A bitter circle of moon had risen, and he could follow the boy's track in the dew. He ducked under the first of the willows, splashed through the spring, and legged up the far bank, skidding in the dampness. Even now his body could relish it. Willow whiffs slapped at his face. The trees were thicker here, and the moon was blotted out. Tree trunks rose in lurching shadows. The grass, now knee-high, caressed him as if pleading with him to slow down, to enjoy the cool, to enjoy the life. Half-rotted dead branches reached for his shins, his cojones. He paused for a moment, lifting his head and scenting at the air. A ghost of a breeze helped him. The boy did not smell good, of course. Neither of them did. The gunslinger's nostrils flared like those of an ape. The younger, lighter odor of the boy's sweat was faint, oily, unmistakable. He crashed over a deadfall of grass and bramble and downed branches, sprinted through a tunnel of overhanging willow and sumac. Moss struck his shoulders like flabby corpse hands. Some clung in sighing gray tendrils. He clawed through a last barricade of willows and came to a clearing that looked up at the stars and the highest peak of the range, gleaming skull-white at an impossible altitude. There was a ring of black standing stones which looked like some sort of surreal animal trap in the moonlight. In the center was a table of stone. An altar, very old, rising out of the ground on a thick arm of basalt. The boy stood before it, trembling back and forth. His hands shook at his sides as if infused with static electricity. The gunslinger called his name sharply, and Jake responded with that inarticulate sound of negation. The faint smear of face, almost hidden by the boy's left shoulder, looked both terrified and exalted. And there was something else. The gunslinger stepped inside the ring, and Jake screamed, recoiling and throwing up his arms. Now his face could be seen clearly. The gunslinger read fear and terror, at war with some excruciating pleasure. The gunslinger felt it touch him. The spirit of the Oracle. The succubus. His loins were suddenly filled with light, a light that was soft, yet hard. He felt his head twisting, his tongue thickening and becoming sensitive to even the spittle that coated it. He didn't think about what he was doing when he pulled the half-rotted jawbone from the pocket where he had carried it since he found it in the lair of the speaking demon at the way station. He didn't think, but it had never frightened him to operate on pure instinct. That had ever been the best and truest place for him. He held the jawbone's frozen, prehistoric grin up before his eyes, holding his other arm out stiffly, first and last fingers poked out in the ancient forked sign, the ward against the evil eye. The current of sensuality was whipped away from him like a drape. Jake screamed again. The gunslinger walked to him and held the jawbone in front of Jake's warring eyes. "See this, Jake. See it very well." What came in response was a wet sound of agony. The boy tried to pull his gaze away, could not. For a moment it seemed that he might be pulled apart, mentally if not physically. Then, suddenly, both eyes rolled up to the whites. Jake collapsed. His body struck the earth limply, one hand almost touching the squat basalt arm that supported the altar. The gunslinger dropped to one knee and picked him up. He was amazingly light, as dehydrated as a November leaf from their long walk through the desert. Around him, Roland could feel the presence that dwelt in the circle of stones, whirring with a jealous anger. Its prize was being taken from it. Once the gunslinger passed out of the circle, the sense of frustrated jealousy faded quickly. He carried Jake back to their camp. By the time they got there, the boy's twitching unconsciousness had become deep sleep. The gunslinger paused for a moment above the gray ruin of the fire. The moonlight on Jake's face reminded him again of a church saint, alabaster purity all unknown. He hugged the kid and put a dry kiss on his cheek, knowing that he loved him. Well, maybe that wasn't quite right. Maybe the truth was that he'd loved the kid from the first moment he'd seen him, as he had Susan Delgado, and was only now allowing himself to recognize the fact. For it was a fact. And it seemed that he could almost feel the laughter from the man in black, someplace far above them. 4. Jake calling him. That was how the gunslinger awoke. He'd tied Jake firmly to one of the tough bushes that grew nearby, and the boy was hungry and upset. By the sun, it was almost 9:30. "Why'd you tie me up?" Jake asked indignantly as the gunslinger loosened the thick knots in the blanket. "I wasn't going to run away." "You did run away," the gunslinger said, and the expression on Jake's face made him smile. "I had to go out and get you. You were sleepwalking."
"I was?"
Jake looked at him suspiciously. "I never did anything like that be—" The gunslinger suddenly produced the jawbone and held it in front of Jake's face. Jake flinched away from it, grimacing and raising his arm. "See?" Jake nodded, bewildered.
"What happened?"
"We don't have time to palaver now. I have to go off for a while. I may be gone the whole day, so listen to me, boy. It's important. If sunset comes and I'm not back—" Fear flashed on Jake's face.
"You're leaving me."
The gunslinger only looked at him.
"No,"
Jake said after a moment.
"I guess if you were going to leave me, you already would have."
"That's using your head. Now listen, and hear me very well. I want you to stay here while I'm gone, right here in camp. Don't stray. Even if it seems like the best idea in the world, and if you feel strange, funny in any way, you pick up this bone and hold it in your hands." Hate and disgust crossed Jake's face, mixed with bewilderment.
"I couldn't. I just couldn't."
"You can. You may have to. Especially after midday. It's important. You may feel pukey or headachy when you first lay hold of it, but that'll pass. Do you understand?"
"Yes."
"And will you do what I say?"
"Yes." "But why do you have to go away?"
Jake burst out. I just do. The gunslinger caught another fascinating glimpse of the steel that lay under the boy's surface. As enigmatic as the story he had told about coming from a city where the buildings were so tall they actually scraped the sky. It wasn't Cuthbert, the boy reminded him of, so much as his other close friend, Alan. Alan had been quiet, in no way prone to Bert's grandstanding quackery, and he'd been dependable and afraid of nothing.
All right, Jake said.
The gunslinger laid the jawbone carefully on the ground next to the ruins of the fire, where it grinned up through the grass like some eroded fossil that has seen the light of day after a night of 5,000 years. Jake wouldn't look at it. His face was pale and miserable. The gunslinger wondered if it would profit them for him to put the boy to sleep and question him, then decided there would be little gain. He knew well enough that the spirit of the stone circle was surely a demon, and very likely an oracle as well. A demon with no shape, only a kind of unformed sexual glare with the eye of prophecy. He wondered briefly if it might not be the soul of Sylvia Pittston, the giant woman whose religious huckstering had led to the final showdown in Tull. But no, not her. The stones in the circle were ancient. Sylvia Pittston was a jilly-come-lately compared to the thing that made its den here. It was old and sly. But the gunslinger knew the forms of speaking quite well and did not think the boy would have to use the jawbone mojo. The voice and mind of the oracle would be more than occupied with him. The gunslinger needed to know things in spite of the risk, and the risk was high. Yet for both Jake and himself, he needed desperately to know. The gunslinger opened his tobacco poke and pawed through it, pushing the dry strands of leaf aside until he came to a minuscule object wrapped in a fragment of white paper. He rolled it between fingers that would all too soon be gone and looked absently up at the sky. Then he unwrapped it and held the contents, a tiny white pill with edges that had been much worn with traveling, in his hand. Jake looked at it curiously. What's that? The gunslinger uttered a short laugh. The story Court used to tell us was that the old gods pissed over the desert and made mescaline. Jake only looked puzzled. This is a drug, the gunslinger said, but not one that puts you to sleep, one that wakes you up all the way for a little while.
Like LSD, the boy agreed instantly and then looked puzzled.
What's that?
I don't know, Jake said. It just popped out. I think it came from, you know, before.
The gunslinger nodded, but he was doubtful. He had never heard of mescaline referred to as LSD, not even in Martin's old books.
Will it hurt you?
Jake asked.
It never has, the gunslinger said, conscious of the evasion.
I don't like it.
Never mind.
The gunslinger squatted in front of the waterskin, took a mouthful, and swallowed the pill. As always, he felt an immediate reaction in his mouth. It seemed overloaded with saliva. He sat down before the dead fire.
When does something happen to you?
Jake asked. Not for a little while. Be quiet. So Jake was quiet, watching with open suspicion as the gunslinger went calmly about the ritual of cleaning his guns. He reholstered them and said, "Your shirt, Jake. Take it off and give it to me." Jake pulled his faded shirt reluctantly over his head, revealing the skinny stack of his ribs, and gave it to Roland. The gunslinger produced a needle that had been threaded into the side seam of his jeans and thread from an empty cartridge loop in his gun belt. He began to sew up a long rip in one of the sleeves of the boy's shirt. As he finished and handed the shirt back, he felt the mask beginning to take hold. There was a tightening in his stomach and a feeling that all the muscles in his body were being cranked up a notch. "I have to go," he said, getting up. "It's time." The boy half rose, his face a shadow of concern, and then he settled back.
"Be careful," he said. "Please?"
Remember the jawbone, the gunslinger said. He put his hand on Jake's head as he went by and tousled the corn-colored hair. The gesture startled him into a short laugh. Jake watched after him with a troubled smile until he was gone into the willow jungle. 5. The gunslinger walked deliberately toward the circle of stones, pausing long enough to get a cool drink from the spring. He could see his own reflection in a tiny pool edged with moss and lily pads, and he looked at himself for a moment as fascinated as Narcissus. The mind reaction was beginning to settle in, slowing down his chain of thought by seeming to increase the connotations of every idea and every bit of sensory input. Things began to take on weight and thickness that had been heretofore invisible. He paused, getting to his feet again, and looked through the tangled snarl of willows. Sunlight slanted through in a golden, dusty bar, and he watched the interplay of motes and tiny flying things for a bit before going on. The drug had often disturbed him. His ego was too strong, or perhaps just too simple, to enjoy being eclipsed and peeled back, made a target for more sensitive emotions. They tickled at him and sometimes maddened him like the touch of a cat's whiskers. But this time he felt fairly calm. That was good. He stepped into the clearing and walked straight into the circle. He stood, letting his mind run free. Yes, it was coming harder now, faster. The grass screamed green at him. It seemed that if he bent over and rubbed his hands in it, he would stand up with green paint all over his fingers and palms. He resisted a puckish urge to try the experiment. But there was no voice from the oracle. No stirring, sexual or otherwise. He went to the altar, stood beside it for a moment. Coherent thought was now almost impossible. His teeth felt strange in his head, tiny tombstones set in pink, moist earth. The world held too much light. He climbed up on the altar and lay back. His mind was becoming a jungle full of strange thought plants that he had never seen or suspected before, a willow jungle that had grown up around a mescaline spring. The sky was water, and he hung suspended over it. The thought gave him a vertigo that seemed far away and unimportant. A line of old poetry occurred to him. Not a nursery voice, no, no. His mother had feared the drugs and the necessity of them, as she had feared court and the need for this beater of boys. This verse came from the Mani folk to the north of the desert, a clan of them still living among machines that usually didn't work, and which sometimes ate the men when they did. The lines played again and again, reminding him, in an unconnected way that was typical of the mescaline rush, of snow falling in a globe he had owned as a child, mystic and half-fantastical. Beyond the reach of human range, a drop of hell, a touch of strange. The trees which overhung the altar contained faces. He watched them with abstracted fascination. Here was a dragon, green and twitching. Here a wood nymph with beckoning branch arms. Here a living skull overgrown with slime. Faces. Faces. The grasses of the clearing suddenly whipped and bent. I come. I come. Vague stirrings in his flesh. How far I have come, he thought, from lying with Susan in sweet grass on the drop to this. She pressed over him, a body made of the wind, a breast of fragrant jasmine, rose, and honeysuckle. Make your prophecy, he said. Tell me what I need to know. His mouth felt full of metal. A sigh, a faint sound of weeping. The gunslinger's genitals felt drawn and hard. Over him and beyond the faces in the leaves, he could see the mountains, hard and brutal and full of teeth. The body moved against him, struggled with him. He felt his hands curl into fists. She had sent him a vision of Susan. It was Susan above him, lovely Susan Delgado, waiting for him in an abandoned drover's hut on the drop, with her hair spilled down her back and over her shoulders. He tossed his head, but her face followed.
Jasmine, rose, honeysuckle, old hay, the smell of love. Love me.
Speak prophecy, he said. Speak truth.
Please, the oracle wept. Don't be cold. It's always so cold here.
Hands slipping over his flesh, manipulating, lighting him on fire, pulling him, drawing, a perfumed black crevice, wet and warm. No, dry, cold, sterile.
Have a touch of mercy, gunslinger. Ah, please, I cry your favor. Mercy.
Would you have mercy on the boy?
What boy? I know no boy. It's not boys I need. Oh, please. Jasmine, rose, honeysuckle, dry hay with its ghost of summer clover, oil decanted from ancient urns, a riot for flesh.
After, he said, if what you tell me is useful.
Now, please, now.
He let his mind coil out at her, the antithesis of emotion. The body that hung over him froze and seemed to scream. There was a brief, vicious tug of war between his temples. His mind was the rope, gray and fibrous. For long moments there was no sound but the quiet hush of his breathing and the faint breeze which made the green faces in the trees shift, wink, and grimace. No bird sang. Her hold loosened. Again there was the sound of sobbing. It would have to be quick, or she would leave him. To stay now meant attenuation, perhaps her own kind of death. Already he felt her chilling, drawing away to leave the circle of stones. Wind rippled the grass in tortured patterns. Prophecy, he said, and then an even bleaker noun. Truth! The weeping, tired sigh. He could almost have granted the mercy she begged, but there was Jake. He would have found Jake dead or insane if he had been any later last night.
Sleep, then.
No.
Then half sleep.
What she asked was dangerous, but also probably necessary. The gunslinger turned his eyes up to the faces in the leaves. A play was being enacted there for his amusement. Worlds rose and fell before him. Empires were built across shining sands where forever machines toiled in abstract electronic frenzies. Empires declined, fell, rose again. Wheels that had spun like silent liquid moved more slowly, began to squeak, began to scream, stopped. Sand choked the stainless steel gutters of concentric streets below dark skies full of stars like beds of cold jewels. And through it all, a dying wind of change blew, bringing with it the cinnamon smell of late October. The gunslinger watched as the world moved on and half slept.
Three. This is the number of your fate.
Three?
Yes, three is mystic. Three stands at the heart of your quest. Another number comes later. Now the number is three.
Which three?
We see in part, and thus is the mirror of prophecy darkened.
Tell me what you can.
The first is young, dark-haired. He stands on the brink of robbery and murder. A demon has infested him. The name of the demon is heroin.
Which demon is that? I know it not, even from my tutor's lessons.
We see in part, and thus is the mirror of prophecy darkened. There are other worlds, gunslinger, and other demons. These waters are deep. Watch for the doorways. Watch for the roses and the unfound doorways.
The second?
She comes on wheels. I see no more.
The third?
Death. But not for you.
The man in black, where is he?
Near. You will speak with him soon.
Of what will we speak?
The tower.
The boy? Jake? Tell me of the boy.
The boy is your gate to the man in black. The man in black is your gate to the three. The three are your way to the dark tower.
How? How can that be? Why must it be?
We see in part, and thus is the mirror.
God damn you!
No. God damned me.
Don't patronize me, thing. What shall I call you, then? Star slut? Whore of the winds? Some live on love that comes to the ancient places, even in these sad and evil times. Some, gunslinger, live on blood, even, I understand, on the blood of young boys. May he not be spared? Yes. How? Cease, gunslinger. Strike your camp and turn back northwest. In the northwest, there is still a need for men who live by the bullet. I am sworn by my father's guns and by the treachery of Martin. Martin is no more. The man in black has eaten his soul. This you know. I am sworn. Then you are damned. Have your way with me, bitch.
6. Eagerness. The shadow swung over him, enfolded him. There was sudden ecstasy, broken only by a galaxy of pain, as faint and bright as ancient stars gone red with collapse. Faces came to him unbidden at the climax of their coupling. Sylvia Pitston, Alice the woman from Tull, Susan, a dozen others. And finally, after an eternity, he pushed her away from him, once again in his right mind, bone-weary and disgusted. "No, it isn't enough. Let me be," the gunslinger said. He sat up and almost fell off the altar before regaining his feet. She touched him tentatively. "Honeysuckle, jasmine, sweet adder." And he pushed her violently, falling to his knees. He made his drunken way to the perimeter of the circle. He staggered through, feeling a huge weight fall from his shoulders. He drew a shuddering, weeping breath. Had he learned enough to justify this feeling of defilement? He didn't know. In time, he supposed he would. As he started away, he could feel her standing at the bars of her prison, watching him go from her. He wondered how long it might be before someone else crossed the desert and found her, hungry and alone. For a moment, he felt dwarfed by the possibilities of time. 7. "You're sick!" Jake stood up fast when the gunslinger shambled back through the last trees and came into camp. He'd been huddled by the ruins of the tiny fire, the jawbone across his knees, gnawing disconsolately on the bones of the rabbit. Now he ran toward the gunslinger with a look of distress that made Roland feel the full, ugly weight of a coming betrayal. "No," he said, "not sick. Just tired. Whipped." He gestured absently at the jawbone. "You can let go of that, Jake." The boy threw it down quickly and violently, rubbing his hands across his shirt after doing it. His upper lip rose and fell in a snarl that was, the gunslinger believed, perfectly unconscious. The gunslinger sat down, almost fell down, feeling the aching joints and the pummeled, thick mind that was the unlovely afterglow of mescaline. His crotch also pulsed with a dull ache. He rolled a cigarette with careful, unthinking slowness. Jake watched. The gunslinger had a sudden impulse to speak to the boy Dundeen after telling him all he had learned, then thrust the idea away with horror. He wondered if a part of him, mind or soul, might not be disintegrating. To open one's mind and heart to the command of a child? The idea was insane. "We sleep here tonight. Tomorrow we start climbing. I'll go out a little later and see if I can't shoot something for supper. We need to make strength. I've got to sleep now, okay?"
"Sure. Knock yourself out."
"I don't understand you."
"Do what you want."
"Ah." The gunslinger nodded and lay back. "Knock myself out," he thought. "Knock myself out." When he woke up, the shadows were long across the small grass clearing. "Build up the fire," he told Jake and tossed him his flint and steel. "Can you use that?"
"Yes, I think so."
The gunslinger walked toward the willow grove and then stopped at the sound of the boy's voice, stopped dead.
"Spark a dock, where's my sire?"
the boy murmured, and Roland heard the sharp chick, chick, chick of the flint. It sounded like the cry of a small mechanical bird.
"Will I lay me, will I stay me, bless this camp with fire?"
"Picked it up from me," the gunslinger thought, not in the least surprised to discover he was all over goosebumps and on the verge of shivering like a wet dog. "Picked it up from me. Words I don't even remember saying. And will I betray such? Ah, Roland, will thee betray such true thread as this in a sad, unthreaded world? Could anything justify it? 'Tis just words. Aye, but old ones. Good ones."
"Roland," the boy called, "are you all right?"
"Yeah," he said gruffly, and the tang of smoke stung faintly in his nose. "He's made fire."
"Yes,"
the boy said simply, and Roland did not need to turn to know the boy was smiling. The gunslinger got moving and bore left, this time skirting the willow grove. At a place where the ground opened out and upward in heavy open grass, he stepped back into the shadows and stood silently. Faintly, clearly, he could hear the crackle of the campfire Jake had rekindled. The sound made him smile. He stood without moving for 10 minutes, 15, 20. 3 rabbits came, and once they were at Silfley, the gunslinger pulled leather. He took them down, skinned them, gutted them, and brought them back to the camp. Jake had water already steaming over the low flames. The gunslinger nodded to him. "That's a good piece of work." Jake flushed with pleasure and silently handed back the flint and steel. While the stew cooked, the gunslinger used the last of the light to go back into the willow grove. Near the first pool, he began to hack at the tough vines that grew near the water's marshy verge. Later, as the fire burned down to coals and Jake slept, he would plait them into ropes that might be of some limited use later. But his intuition was that the climb would not be a particularly difficult one. He felt Kaa at work on the surface of things, and no longer even considered it odd. The vines bled green sap over his hands as he carried them back to where Jake waited. They were up with the sun and packed in half an hour. The gunslinger hoped to shoot another rabbit in the meadow as they fed, but time was short and no rabbit showed itself. The bundle of their remaining food was now so small and light that Jake carried it easily. He had toughened up, this boy. You could see it. The gunslinger carried their water, freshly drawn from one of the springs. He looped his 3 vine ropes around his belly. They gave the circle of stones a wide berth. The gunslinger was afraid the boy might feel a recurrence of fear, but when they passed above it on a stony rise, Jake only offered it a passing glance and then looked at a bird that hovered upwind. Soon enough, the trees began to lose their height and lushness. Trunks were twisted, and roots seemed to struggle with the earth in a tortured hunt for moisture.
"It's all so old," Jake said glumly when they paused for a rest. "Isn't there anything young in this world?"
The gunslinger smiled and gave Jake an elbow. "You are," he said. Jake responded with a wan smile.
"Will it be hard to climb?"
The gunslinger looked at him, curious. "The mountains are high. Don't you think it'll be a hard climb?" Jake looked back at him, his eyes clouded, puzzled.
"No."
They went on. Eight. The sun climbed to its zenith, seemed to hang there more briefly than it ever had during the desert crossing, and then passed on, returning them their shadows. Shelves of rock protruded from the rising land like the arms of giant easy chairs buried in the earth. The scrub grass turned yellow and sere, Finally, they were faced with a deep chimney-like crevasse in their path, and they scaled a short, peeling rise of rock to get around and above it. The ancient granite had faulted on lines that were step-like, and as they had both intuited, the beginning of their climb, at least, was easy. They paused on the 4-foot-wide scarp at the top and looked back over the land to the desert, which curled around the upland like a huge yellow paw. Further off, it gleamed at them in a white shield that dazzled the eye, receding into dim waves of rising heat. The gunslinger felt faintly amazed at the realization that this desert had nearly murdered him. From where they stood, in a new coolness, the desert certainly appeared momentous, but not deadly. They turned back to the business of the climb, scrambling over jackstraw falls of rock and crouch-walking up inclined planes of stone shot with glitters of quartz and mica. The rock was pleasantly warm to the touch, but the air was definitely cooler. In the late afternoon, the gunslinger heard the faint sound of thunder. The rising line of the mountains obscured the sight of the rain on the other side, however. When the shadows began to turn purple, they camped in the overhang of a jutting brow of rock. The gunslinger anchored their blanket above and below, fashioning a kind of shanty lean-to. They sat at the mouth of it, watching the sky spread a cloak over the world. Jake dangled his feet over the drop. The gunslinger rolled his evening smoke and eyed Jake half-humorously. "Don't roll over in your sleep," he said, "or you may wake up in hell."
"I won't,"
Jake replied seriously.
"My mother says..."
He broke it off. "She says what?"
"That I sleep like a dead man,"
Jake finished.
He looked at the gunslinger, who saw that the boy's mouth was trembling as he strove to keep back tears.
"Only a boy," he thought. And pain smote him, the ice pick that too much cold water can sometimes plant in the forehead. "Only a boy. Why?" Silly question. When a boy, wounded in body or spirit, called that question out to court, that ancient scarred battle engine, whose job it was to teach the sons of gunslingers the beginning of what they had to know, court would answer, "Why is a crooked letter and can't be made straight? Never mind why, just get up, pusshead. Get up, the day's young."
"Why am I here?" Jake asked. "Why did I forget everything from before?"
"Because the man in black has drawn you here," the gunslinger said. "And because of the tower. The tower stands at a kind of power nexus in time."
"I don't understand that."
"Nor do I," the gunslinger said. "But something has been happening, just in my own time. The world has moved on, we say. We've always said. But it's moving on faster now. Something has happened to time. It's softening." They sat in silence. A breeze, faint but with an edge, picked at their legs. Somewhere it made a hollow whoo in a rock fissure.
"Where do you come from?" Jake asked.
"From a place that no longer exists. Do you know the Bible?"
"Jesus and Moses, sure."
The gunslinger smiled. "That's right. My land had a biblical name. New Canaan, it was called. The land of milk and honey. In the Bible's Canaan, there were supposed to be grapes so big that men had to carry them on sledges. We didn't grow them that big, but it was sweet land."
"I know about Ulysses," Jake said hesitantly. "Was he in the Bible?"
"Maybe," the gunslinger said. "I was never a scholar of it, and can't say for sure."
"But the others? Your friends?"
"No others," the gunslinger said. "I'm the last." A tiny, wasted moon began to rise, casting its slitted gaze down into the tumble of rocks where they sat.
"Was it pretty?" Your country? Your land?
It was beautiful, the gunslinger said. There were fields and forests and rivers and mists in the morning. But that's only pretty. My mother used to say that the only real beauty is order and love and light.
Jake made a noncommittal noise. The gunslinger smoked and thought of how it had been. The knights in the huge central hall. Hundreds of richly clad figures moving through the slow, steady waltz steps or the faster, light ripples of the polkam. Aileen Ritter on his arm, the one his parents had chosen for him, he supposed, her eyes brighter than the most precious gems. The light of the crystal-enclosed sparklights shining in the newly done hair of the courtesans and their half-cynical amours. The hall had been huge, an island of light whose age was beyond telling, as was the whole central place, which was made up of nearly 100 stone castles. It had been unknown years since he had seen it, and leaving for the last time, Roland had ached as he turned his face away from it and began his first cast for the trail of the man in black. Even then, the walls had fallen. Weeds grew in the courtyards. Bats roosted amongst the great beams of the central hall, and the galleries echoed with the soft swoop and whisper of swallows. The fields where Court had taught them archery and gunnery and falconry were gone to hay and timothy and wild vines. In the huge kitchen where Hax had once held his fuming and aromatic court, a grotesque colony of slow mutants nested, peering at him from the merciful darkness of pantries and shadowed pillars. The warm steam that had been filled with the pungent odors of roasting beef and pork had changed to the clammy damp of moss. Giant white toadstools grew in corners where not even the slow muties dared to encamp. The huge oak sub-cellar bulkhead stood open, and the most poignant smell of all had issued from that, an odor that seemed to express with a flat finality all the hard facts of dissolution and decay. The high, sharp odor of wine gone to vinegar. It had been no struggle to turn his face to the south and leave it behind. But it had hurt his heart.
"Was there a war?" Jake asked.
"Even better," the gunslinger said, and pitched the last smoldering ember of his cigarette away. "There was a revolution. We won every battle and lost the war. No one won the war, unless maybe it was the scavengers. There must have been rich pickings for years after."
"I wish I'd lived there,"
Jake said wistfully. "Do you say so?"
"I do."
"Time to turn in, Jake." The boy, now only a dim shadow, turned on his side and curled up with the blanket tossed loosely over him. The gunslinger sat sentinel over him for perhaps an hour after, thinking his long, sober thoughts. Such meditation was a novel thing for him, sweet in a melancholy sort of way, but still utterly without practical value. There was no solution to the problem of Jake, other than the one the oracle had offered. And turning away was simply not possible. There might have been tragedy in the situation, but the gunslinger did not see that. He saw only the predestination that had always been there. And finally, his more natural character reasserted itself, and he slept deeply, with no dreams. Nine. The climb became grimmer on the following day as they continued to angle toward the narrow V of the pass through the mountains. The gunslinger pushed slowly, still with no sense of hurry. The dead stone beneath their feet left no trace of the man in black. But the gunslinger knew he had been this way before them, and not only from the path of his climb, as he and Jake had observed him, tiny and bug-like, from the foothills. His aroma was printed on every cold downdraft of air. It was an oily, sardonic odor, as bitter to the nose as the stench of the devil grass.
Jake's hair had grown much longer, and it curled slightly at the base of his sunburned neck. He climbed tough, moving with sure-footedness and no apparent acrophobia as they crossed gaps or scaled their way up ledged facings. Twice already, he'd gone up in places the gunslinger could not have managed, and anchored one of the ropes so the gunslinger could climb up hand over hand. The following morning they climbed through a coldly damp snatch of cloud that blotted out the tumbled slopes below them. Patches of hard, granulated snow began to appear, nestled in some of the deeper pockets of stone. It glittered like quartz, and its texture was as dry as sand. That afternoon they found a single footprint in one of these snow patches. Jake stared at it for a moment with awful fascination, then looked up frightfully, as if expecting to see the man in black materialize into his own footprint. The gunslinger tapped him on the shoulder then and pointed ahead. "Go. The day's getting old." Later they made camp in the last of the daylight on a wide, flat ledge to the east and north of the cut that slanted into the heart of the mountains. The air was frigid. They could see the puffs of their breath, and the humid sound of thunder in the red and purple afterglow of the day was surreal, slightly lunatic. The gunslinger thought the boy might begin to question him, but there were no questions from Jake. The boy fell almost immediately into sleep. The gunslinger followed his example. He dreamed again of Jake as an alabaster saint with a nail through his forehead. He awoke with a gasp, tasting the cold thinness of altitude in his lungs. Jake was asleep beside him, but his sleep was not easy. He twisted and mumbled to himself, chasing his own phantoms. The gunslinger lay over uneasily and slept again. Ten. A week after Jake saw the footstep, they faced the man in black for a brief moment in time. In that moment, the gunslinger felt he could almost understand the implication of the tower itself, for that moment seemed to stretch out forever. They continued southeast, reaching a point perhaps halfway through the Cyclopean mountain range, and just as the going seemed about to become really difficult for the first time, above them, seeming to lean out, the icy ledges and screaming buttes made the gunslinger feel an unpleasant reverse vertigo. They began to descend again along the side of the narrow pass. An angular zigzagging path led them toward a canyon floor where an ice-edged stream boiled with slaty headlong power from higher country still. On that afternoon, the boy paused and looked back at the gunslinger who had paused to wash his face in the stream.
"I smell him," Jake said.
"So do I."
Ahead of them, the mountain threw up its final defense, a huge slab of insurmountable granite facing that climbed into cloudy infinity. At any moment, the gunslinger expected a twist in the stream to bring them upon a high waterfall and the insurmountable smoothness of rock, dead end. But the air here had that odd magnifying quality that is common to high places, and it was another day before they reached that great granite face. The gunslinger began to feel the tug of anticipation again, the feeling that it was all finally in his grasp. He'd been through this before, many times, and still he had to fight himself to keep from breaking into an eager trot. "Wait!" The boy had stopped suddenly. They faced a sharp elbow bend in the stream. It boiled and frothed around the eroded hang of a giant sandstone boulder. All that morning they had been in the shadow of the mountains as the canyon narrowed. Jake was trembling violently, and his face had gone pale. "What's the matter?"
"Let's go back," Jake whispered. "Let's go back, quick."
The gunslinger's face was wooden.
"Please?"
The boy's face was drawn, and his jawline shook with suppressed agony. Through the heavy blanket of stone, they still heard thunder as steady as machines in the earth. The slice of sky they could see had itself assumed a turbulent, gothic gray above them as warm and cold currents met and warred.
"Please, please,"
The boy raised a fist, as if to strike the gunslinger's chest.
No.
The boy's face took on wonder.
You're going to kill me. He killed me the first time, and you're going to kill me this time. And I think you know it.
The gunslinger felt the lie on his lips, then spoke it.
You'll be all right.
And a greater lie yet. I'll take care. Jake's face went gray, and he said no more. He put an unwilling hand out, and he and the gunslinger went around the elbow bend that way, hand in hand. On the other side, they came face to face with that final rising wall and the man in black. He stood no more than 20 feet above them, just to the right of the waterfall that crashed and spilled from a huge ragged hole in the rock. Unseen wind rippled and tugged at his hooded robe. He held a staff in one hand. The other hand he held out to them in a mocking gesture of welcome. He seemed a prophet. And below that rushing sky, mounted on a ledge of rock, a prophet of doom. His voice, the voice of Jeremiah. Gunslinger, how well you fulfill the prophecies of old. Good day and good day and good day. He laughed and bowed, the sound echoing over the bellow of the falling water. Without a thought, the gunslinger had drawn his pistols. The boy cowered to his right and behind, a small shadow. Roland fired 3 times before he could gain control of his traitor hands. The echoes bounced their bronze tones against the rock valley that rose around them over the sound of the wind and water. A spray of granite puffed over the head of the man in black. A second to the left of his hood, a third to the right. He had missed cleanly. All 3 times. The man in black laughed, a full, hearty laugh that seemed to challenge the receding echo of gunshots. Would you kill all your answers so easily, gunslinger? Come down, the gunslinger said. Do that, I beg you, and we'll have answers all around. Again that huge, derisive laugh. It's not your bullets, I fear, Roland. It's your idea of answers that scares me. Come down. We'll speak on the other side, I think, the man in black said. On the other side, we will hold much counsel and long palaver. His eyes flicked to Jake, and he added, Just the two of us. Jake flinched away from him with a small, whining cry, and the man in black turned, his robe swirling in the gray air like a batwing. He disappeared into the cleft in the rock from which the water spewed at full force. The gunslinger exercised grim will and did not send a bullet after him. Would you kill all your answers so easily, gunslinger? There was only the sound of wind and water, a sound that had been in this place of desolation for 1,000 years. Yet the man in black had stood there. 12 years after his last glimpse, Roland had seen him close up again, had spoken to him, and the man in black had laughed. On the other side, we will hold much counsel and long palaver. The boy looked up at him, his body trembling. For a moment, the gunslinger saw the face of Allie, the girl from Tull, superimposed over Jake's, the scar standing out on her forehead like a mute accusation, and felt brute loathing for them both. It wouldn't occur to him until much later that both the scar on Alice's forehead and the nail he saw spike through Jake's forehead in his dreams were in the same place. Jake, perhaps, caught a whiff of his thought. A moan slipped from his throat. Then he twisted his lips and cut the sound off. He held the makings of a fine man. Perhaps a gunslinger in his own right, if given time. Just the two of us. The gunslinger felt a great and unholy thirst in some deep unknown pit of his body, one no draught of water or wine could touch. Worlds trembled, almost within reach of his fingers, and in some instinctual way he strove not to be corrupted, knowing in his colder mind that such strife was vain and always would be. In the end, there was only Carl. It was noon. He looked up, letting the cloudy, unsettled daylight shine for the last time on the all-too-vulnerable son of his own righteousness. No one ever really pays for betrayal in silver, he thought. The price of any betrayal always comes due in flesh. Come with me or stay, the gunslinger said. The boy responded to this with a hard and humorless grin. His father's grin, had he but known it.
And I'll be fine if I stay, he said. Fine all by myself here in the mountains. Someone will come and save me. They'll have cake and sandwiches. Coffee in a thermos, too. Do you say so?
Come with me or stay, the gunslinger repeated, and felt something happen in his mind, an uncoupling. That was the moment at which the small figure before him ceased to be Jake and became only the boy, an impersonality to be moved and used. Something screamed in the windy stillness. He and the boy both heard. The gunslinger began to climb, and after a moment, Jake came after. Together they mounted the tumbled rock beside the steely, cold falls and stood where the man in black had stood before them. And together they entered in where he had disappeared. The darkness swallowed them.